Welcome to another edition of Britainology, the show that attempts to disentangle the scary underbelly of the nation of Britain and to discover what makes it tick, what is concealed in the slime of Britain's inner workings. I'm Milo Edwards, and I'm joined, as ever, by my co-host, Nate Bethay.
Hello, yes, it's a lovely day in Britain. The sun is out. Sun is supposed to be out for like the next 10 days. It's shocking down here in the southeast of England. We don't know what's going on. It's not supposed to be nice, but it is for once. Everyone's losing their minds.
Yeah, this is simply uncharted territory for Britain. Nice weather.
Things are going well.
I was going to say, how are things up in Glasgow, Alice? I figured I should ask you.
Let me put it this way, right? I'm looking out of my window currently. I can see three different shades of grey. And that's it.
the slightly less erotic Scottish version.
Yeah, exactly. One of them is the sky, one of them is the pavement, and the other one is the dead trees in between the sky and the pavement. So I'm doing great.
I mean, winters in the Midwest are pretty bleak, don't get me wrong, but I think like a week solid stretch of uninterrupted, the sky is nothing but straight gray with no interruption. It's just... it does something to you mentally, and I feel that explains a lot of this country.
If you wanna do a Scotlandology, I feel like that's an essential part to understanding this this nation within our country. Is that no one has ever seen any color at any time because it all just sort of melds into gray.
It also seems to make sense that it's what drives people completely bonkers when you do get warm summer weather. Like the shitness of the milieu of the movie Trainspotting wouldn't exist if not also for summer weather means we go out in the park and shoot guys with a pellet gun.
Oh yeah, as soon as it gets above about, I want to say 15 degrees, Glaswegians all take their shirts off and just walk around. And if it's actually hot, which it never is, but if it actually is hot as opposed to Glasgow hot, then they just sort of broil. And so the effect is kind of very like lobstery, just sort of people walking around, you can hear them sizzling.
Yeah, you got the Glasgow kiss, which is headbutting someone, and then you've got Glasgow hot, which is anything above 5 degrees centigrade.
I remember years ago there was a Scottish guy had tweeted one of your sort of local Scottish tweets of, you know, like 2 days fixing me roof, etc. And he was like the best way I could describe it was...
What do people do in Scotland? Fixing their roof.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he'd been on his roof in the middle of summer all day with his shirt off. And, like, the best way I could describe it is you couldn't see the red as much because of the blisters. Because he was so hideously sunburned.
Oh, it's bad. Like, as soon as we started getting cheap package holidays to places with actual sun, like Spain, if you've ever been on an EasyJet flight or like a cheap flight on the way back from Spain, just people who like leave half of their back skin on the plane when they get up and like disentangle themselves from the seats.
Oh, like, man. A boa constrictor. Yeah.
Well, I just remember that someone had quote tweeted this guy. It was a black American dude had quote tweeted this guy's post and said, "And y'all folks stay believing they built the pyramids." And it's like, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Look, and you see what the sun does to people with my complexion or Alice's complexion or Milo's complexion. And it's like, yeah, I don't think we were building pyramids.
But well, you know the idea that there is a contention that Scotsmen built the pyramids.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, I think it's in the general, that the Scottish people do definitely fall within the general purview of white people.
We do definitely be spending 2 days up fixing the roof of our pyramid.
Yeah, exactly. And I was going to say, there's another country that has pyramids. It's where the pyramids were built. It's Egypt. And we're going to talk about that today. We're going to talk about the nation of Egypt and specifically Britain's last mad dash at relevance when it tried to overthrow Nasser.
We've had many since.
Yeah. Our raging against the dying of the light, the Suez Crisis.
Yeah. What a crisis it was. The more this is something that I thought I knew about, and then the more I've read about it over the last couple of days, the more I've been like, what the fuck was going on there?
Well, the thing is, people in the 1950s were all totally fucking insane. And we'll get into this, but like a combination of sort of leaded petrol, over-the-counter amphetamines, and like the long hangover
of
two centuries of empire. Yeah.
Yeah,
all of those things conspire, right, to create a very febrile atmosphere in Westminster.
So I feel like Britain heads who have watched season one of The Crown will recall that the Suez Crisis gets a little bit of a treatment and even some combat scene reenactments. But I think the thing that sticks in my mind the most is that Anthony Eden travels to the United States to meet with John Foster Dulles and winds up passing out from, I think, either lack of insulin or like taking too much morphine or something like that. And they find him like in the waiting room at the State Department, which was like blood seeping into his shirt from an injection site. And it's just sort of like, yeah, I mean, that is a picture of Britain that we all recognize now, isn't it?
You can't expect people to make foreign policy decisions without doing some laudanum first.
No,
I mean,
absolutely.
Come on.
Sets the tone.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, so essentially, in a nutshell, the Suez Crisis was when Britain, France, and the dang joker, Israel, decided to conspire to seize control of the Suez Canal after Nasser.
It's weird. We went in together on a little war. Like, we went halves on a war in secret.
Yeah, and my favorite part of this, which is going to come up, is that Britain and France had totally planned it with Israel, but were doing like the magician thing with Israel of going, now, you and I have never met before, correct? You decided to invade Israel entirely of your own accord, and we've never spoken before. Egypt, rather.
Yeah, well,
they
we
didn't
have to
decide
talk
to
about
invade Israel.
Based giga chat, Gamal Abdel Nasser. Like, the one man, it seems, in this story who was not doing, like, two or three shots of laudanum a day.
Yeah. It seems as though, like you say, everyone involved in this was completely insane. I guess we may as well begin from the beginning, which is, I've got some brief history of the Suez Canal here. So it was opened in 1869 as a collaboration between the French and Egyptian governments. And essentially revolutionized global shipping because it enabled ships to get from the Indian Ocean through to the Mediterranean without sailing around the Horn of Africa. And then in 1875, the British government came to acquire 44% of it for £4 million because the then... I think, in a bet. More or less. Because the then ruler of Egypt, who wasn't a king but was something akin to a king, had basically run out of money and had to sell his stake in it. And the Suez Canal also played an interesting role in the Russo-Japanese War of 1905 because...
Yes, I know the story.
One of my favorite little military tidbits, which threw me back to GCSE history, which is that the British decided to refuse the Russian Baltic Fleet passage through the Suez Canal to go and fight the Japanese. And so they were forced to sail around the Horn of Africa, which took them 6 months and were then destroyed in like 6 hours.
They also managed to shoot up a bunch of British trawlers on the way there. And their admiral was so furious at everything that he had this habit of throwing his binoculars off the bridge. So they set sail with extra binoculars in a cabinet because otherwise they would have run out.
That is the most powerful Russian energy, having lots of spare binoculars. Whereas I think the British naval officer energy would be more throwing yourself off the bridge.
Yeah, exactly. The binoculars are valuable. You, on the other hand, no, absolutely not. You just sort of like sit there very sort of like clenched on these binoculars until the ship either like sinks or you throw yourself off of it.
I was trying to think what the equivalent American military officer, you know, behavior would be here. And it wouldn't be destroying the binoculars because, like you said, they're too valuable. It wouldn't be throwing yourself off because we just simply won't do that. It wouldn't be throwing the binoculars because or you know, having replacement ones because all those things are serial number items. And then it came to me, it would be having a second binocular case that you just used to dip tobacco spit into. You have one case for the binos and then you have another case. You just... Right, every time you need to, you know what solves a problem.
That U.S. Admiral J.W. Pepper.
Yeah, it's not as far off as you might imagine.
Now, a crucial element of the Suez Canal was that it enabled the transport of oil. Because there were some pipelines which ran across the Middle East and into the Mediterranean, but these were unreliable due to reasons. And the British basically decided that the Suez Canal was like key to the oil supply in Britain. Although what they kind of didn't predict was that actually quite soon oil tankers were going to get so big that they wouldn't be able to use the Suez Canal anyway.
Yeah, we were totally wrong about this, which is so funny that it became like this linchpin of our foreign policy. And then it just became sort of largely irrelevant even while this was happening.
Yeah, incredible. I mean, again, a powerful British energy there to just completely misread the room, but go in feet first, nevertheless. And so the British have been like quite involved in Egypt in the run up to the 1950s. But escalating tensions caused a military coup by the Egyptian Nationalist Free Officers Movement led by Nasser.
Let me be clear, our boy in this episode, the most normal man by far within 500 miles of this,
and he wasn't that normal of a man.
No, but absolutely not by the standards of you or I. No, insane. However, by the standards of this podcast, by the standards of Britannology, and by the standards of Anthony Eden, yeah, no, by far the most rational person here. Incidentally, by the way, the king that he overthrew, King Farouk, who went to exile in Italy, possessed the world's largest collection of pornography, amongst other things, which they found when they were clearing out his palace.
How did they decide that it was the world's largest collection?
I suppose someone had to have measured it by weight.
I seem to recall a detail about King Farouk that he was an enormous man, and that he would have like a Jeroboam of champagne with every dinner.
Yeah, he was a huge guy. He banned Ben-Hur just in case Egyptians thought, like, watching Nero, this huge fat Roman emperor, was just like, oh yeah, that's the king.
Well, you know what? I don't want people making dangerous associations.
He was the opposite of representation matters. He was like, do not represent me in media.
Do not perceive me. Yeah. Do not, under any circumstances, perceive my pornography.
He just wanted to like be left alone, not be perceived, and collect a shitload of like esoteric things. Were it not for the like difference in pornography, he's just like me. He had a shitload of collections of Geiger counters and stuff, and it's just like monarchy is the best system for determining who gets to run a country. Just this enormous like porn brained probably autistic guy just collecting enough random shit to like weigh down his yacht.
Train loving Egyptian ruler King Farouk.
Imagine if you were like one of the royal servants and your job was to like concoct some sort of, you know, early 19th century glass cleaning solvent in order to like wipe clean all these daguerreotypes of porn that he's jacked off to.
Because
you know they're going to be daguerreotypes, you know, it's going to be really, he's going to have old shit in there as well as like prints and stuff. So we all know, you know, like porn go, that's one of the first things people did when they started being able to make photographs was start getting horny with it. And like, respect to them, 100%. Respect, well, measured and conditional respect to King Farouk for loving porn so much, not for any of the other things.
So in this period after Nasser gains control of Egypt, there are the Brits basically attempt to come to some arrangement with Nasser about the eventual withdrawal of British troops from the kind of canal area, and the Suez Canal Company is going to revert to the control of the Egyptian government in 1968. But Nasser isn't all that keen on the Brits because the Brits are very closely involved with the kings of Iraq and Jordan. And essentially, Nasser is quite concerned that the Brits are trying to create some kind of new order in the Middle East, which is going to be centered around Iraq because Iraq favors the Brits.
Yeah, he has a huge beef with the Prime Minister of Iraq, Nouri al-Sayed. And so, like, that's their issue, is like which form of Arabism or pan-Arabism is going to dominate the Arab world. As a part of this, though, incidentally, one of the things that Nasser does is try to aid the struggle for independence in Algeria, thus making a blood enemy of thousands of psychotic Frenchmen who are absolutely determined that their little village of Jejen-sur-la-Plage be, totally, totally unmolested by any of the people who actually lived there first.
Including the incredibly normal branches of the French colonial paratroopers, who are just a bunch of guys having a good time. Mm-hmm. That now, speaking of relations between Middle Eastern countries and how normal they are, here's a section of the history which I've marked in my notes. I quote here. The Americans took the view that just as fear of the Soviet Union had helped to end the historic Franco-German enmity, so too could anti-communism and the more recent Arab-Israeli dispute. It was a source of constant puzzlement to American officials in the 1950s that the Arab states and the Israelis had seemed to have more interest in fighting each other than uniting against the Soviet Union.
Weird how that works.
The Americans here really do come off like sort of Graham Greene characters. They're like, they're imperialists, but they're bumbling imperialists, where Britain and France are these sort of like venomous Malin actors. You have particularly John Foster Dulles, the American Secretary of State, just comes across as really fucking stupid. He's like, why aren't you guys as big into the anti-communism as we are? Surely you can like mend fences over this.
Why can't these Israelis and these Arabs just get along?
Yeah, exactly.
Also, something that I think bears mention, just as an aside, is that the Soviet Union was very invested in Egypt and in Israel. Like, not necessarily as, you know, call it coalition partners, but they had a lot of economic development in both countries. I would say that's something that people may not realize about, you know, if you're our age or younger, people may not realize that, like, there was a time when the government, because of the non-aligned movement and also because of just economic cooperation, the governments of countries like Egypt, but certainly countries like India and Israel were closer to the Soviet Union than they were to the United States by a significant margin.
Yeah, and you have this like thing of like playing one against the other. Who's the Prime Minister of Afghanistan who said that he was happiest lighting American cigarettes with Soviet matches?
I wish I could tell you, but I do not know. There were just so many of them. They kind of got cycled through so quickly. Let's be perfectly honest.
I'm happiest lighting American cigarettes with American Stinger missile rays.
every single one of these guys was like, I'm playing both sides, so I always come out on top, and 6 months later gets assassinated by their most trusted advisor.
Yeah, I definitely, something that came out for me reading about this was the extent to which like the Brits and the French are being completely insane. And so what that occludes is how the Americans are being insane in a very different way, where like the Americans are trying to be like, well, we couldn't possibly sanction some kind of illegal incursion onto another country's territory just to achieve some kind of strategic objective. This is completely, but then all of the reasons why they're not doing this are based on like completely mad things about like, yeah, I want Egypt and Israel to unite against the Soviet Union.
Let's also bear in mind that when this is taking place, it was only 8 years prior that Egypt had invaded Israel along with a bunch of other Arab countries in the 1948 war. And so there's a whole fucking multi-part series you can do on how that war started out. And a lot of it started out with, let's just say, unclear levels of provocation between both belligerents. However, the idea of those two countries, or of any Arab country being partners with Israel in 1956, would be absurd considering that there had just been an enormous conflict between them in the previous decade. That would be, the best way I could describe it is like, it's 1992 and you're like, Iran, Iraq, why can't you guys just get along? I'm talking in Joker voice for some reason. But seriously though, I mean, that like that
you
level
know how
of,
I got these fast patrol boats. So on the 26th of July, 1956, NASA gives this speech where he is talking about the Suez Canal, and he pronounces the name aloud of Ferdinand de Lesseps, the Frenchman who designed the canal, which is like a code word to Egyptian forces to like seize control of it.
NASA loved this shit because he was like a born showman and also incredibly secretive. And that's one thing that's true of every single guy that we're going to talk about, is they are all like burning their own mail every day, kind of secretive, because that's just how like politicians were in the 50s. So the Egyptian military like had a week's notice before this that they were going to occupy the Suez Canal, and they only knew for certain when he gave the big speech, which had some modern resonances, I suppose. You have to paint like a big Z on all of your vehicles and then just drive east.
Yeah, that's something else I noticed while reading through this is the parallels between a lot of the military action taken here and stuff going on in Ukraine right now is quite striking, particularly not necessarily in the global sense, but in the kind of small details. Essentially, he comes up with this plan where the Suez Canal Company is going to be forcibly nationalized by the Egyptian government, but they're going to pay all of the current shareholders that day's closing price on the Paris Stock Exchange, which, if you're being expropriated, not that bad, really.
No, it's like it's force majeure or whatever. It's not like it wasn't even illegal as far as anyone could tell. It was just like unwise as far as Western powers were concerned, because like if you can unilaterally abrogate this one thing that we've imposed on you, you do it with anything, and anyone could do it. So, like, even if they were fond of NASA, and they weren't, I mean, this could lead to just about anyone saying, okay, well, the oil's not coming.
I believe the technical British legal term for this is not cricket.
Yeah, exactly.
and it says that same day, Egypt closed the canal to Israeli shipping, including the Straits of Tiran and the Gulf of Aqaba, which are, like, other kind of seafaring corridors in the area. And as ever, the Middle East is being the Middle East. This section I've entitled "Meanwhile, we welcome what the Prime Minister has said," because this is the Labour leader going intensely Keir Starmer mode. Eden was hosting a dinner for King Faisal II of Iraq and his Prime Minister Nur as-Said when he learned that the canal had been nationalised. They both unequivocally advised Eden to hit NASA hard, hit him soon, and hit him by himself, which is a great quote in and of itself, a stance shared by the vast majority of the British people in subsequent weeks. There is a lot of humbug about Suez, Guy Millard, one of Eden's private secretaries, later recorded. People forget that the policy at the time was extremely popular. Opposition leader Hugh Gaitskell was also at the dinner. He immediately agreed that military action might be inevitable, but warned Eden that he would have to keep the Americans closely informed. So he did welcome what the Prime Minister has said, but he did also encourage him to go further by keeping the Americans informed.
We should talk about Anthony Eden, because this was a fucking guy, right? Eden had become Prime Minister at the end of like a long career in the Foreign Ministry. And the Foreign Office. He was like a sort of a diplomat by nature. And what's really funny is that he was sort of like notorious among more conservative politicians and like civil servants for being like a fop, essentially. Like, oh, he has a fancy little hat that becomes named after him. He varnishes his nails. And one of the things is that he has these like striking good looks that he preserves into old age, and everybody's very jealous, and they think he's like this Svengali like figure who can use his charm and his talent and his beauty and these sort of like quite feminine traits to his advantage. And then I'd like you to look up a picture of Anthony Eden at any point right now, because this is not the same person that these people are describing. It's just this was sort of what passed for these things in the 1950s, and it's so weird in hindsight.
Yeah, I mean, like, he doesn't look like he has gout. He has a full head of hair, and he has an enormous mustache. Like, he's not a bad-looking guy, but he's certainly not beautiful, we'll put it that way. Like, he doesn't look like a gracefully aging twink. He just looks like 1950s man.
Yeah, he looks like your uncle from the 1950s, kind of. And the only time I've ever understood this was when I saw a picture of him at the Yalta conference next to Churchill. And Churchill is, of course, looks like an enormous baby that someone has put into a suit as a joke. And next to him, Anthony Eden is, like, standing normally. And you're just like, oh, okay. That Churchill was everybody's baseline for what a guy looked like back then. And it was only when this like relatively normal looking man showed up that all of these people were like a modern Adonis.
Yeah, basically Anthony Eden looks like if Joseph Stalin had been a ballet dancer and had retained his physique to some extent.
Yeah, this is as we know, British people hadn't invented being good looking until some point in the 1960s. Yeah. And so Anthony Eden is a kind of first draft. He's an attempt at creating a normal looking man.
Every guy who was good looking in Britain went to prison for being friends with Oscar Wilde, and it just extirpated their lineage.
That's right, yeah. Being a hot guy in Britain was cause for suspicion. You couldn't do that then.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the British government was kind of, were trying to develop the first hot British man as a kind of like Asimo type project. They were like unveiling him at conferences.
Like falls down the stairs like Asimo, but only because he hasn't been doing enough amphetamines that day. Oh yeah, also I should point out, like highly strung does not quite cut it. My man was sleeping 5 hours a day if he was lucky. He was also like, I'm not using amphetamines as a joke. He was very badly addicted to them and was using them compulsively. So he develops this sort of like obsessive hatred of NASA in particular. Like he says to one of his cabinet secretaries, you know, I don't talk to me about neutralizing him. I want him murdered. Like it's almost unprecedented bluntness, and that's just like very out of character for Eden, as it seems, but that's sort of how he became. And like I think this is the thing, like both British and French politicians were kind of driven a bit mad by NASA, partly out of like, well, mostly out of racism, I would say, like the sort of air of surprise that an Arab leader is like credible in any way seems to have been a bit to them like your armchair talking to you all of a sudden. It's just really startled them,
which it does sometimes do when you've had a lot of laudanum.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's something I definitely noticed about this, is that sort of like it's very interesting contrasting Eden with Guy Mollet, the French prime minister, where like Eden is kind of like a Tory who's having these like weird liberal moments in the context of the Suez Crisis, where he's like constantly fretting about like civilian casualties and like restricting of the caliber of the guns that the Brits are allowed to use to bombard cities and stuff for this reason. Whereas the French guy who's supposed to be a socialist is like, we will destroy them all. There's sort of like this weird kind of Freaky Friday situation. But yeah, so basically in July 1956, the French and the Israelis decide that they're going to take some kind of military action against Egypt. And they invite the Brits to get involved, at which point what I've described as a cunning plan emerges. 3 months after Egypt's nationalization of the Suez Canal Company, a secret meeting took place at Sèvres outside Paris. Britain and France enlisted Israeli support for an alliance against Egypt. The parties agreed that Israel would invade the Sinai. Britain and France would then intervene, purportedly to separate the warring Israeli and Egyptian forces, instructing both to withdraw to a distance of 16 kilometers from either side of the canal. Yeah, Britain practicing for Northern Ireland here. we're just going to force a peace between these two warring sides, neither of which we prefer over the other.
It's a peace canal.
Yeah, that's right. It's so funny to be like, in which the canal, which we want to control, conveniently forms a useful border between these two forces who simply must be kept apart for their own good. Yeah, Britain and France basically holding Israel back. It's not worth it.
Ben-Gurion wasn't very happy about the idea of Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion was not very happy about the idea of Israel like sort of playing the aggressor here while Britain and France get to come out of it clean. But on the other hand, they had just discovered oil in the Sinai, so he kind of came around.
Yeah, Ben-Gurion being like, excuse me, you want me to pretend to be an aggressor?
just really sell it. If you think you're up to it, we need you to like really, really use the Israeli Defense Forces quite aggressively. And it's like, oh, I don't know. It's kind of a stretch.
Although I will say I'm not saying this in the defense of Israel's ruling party or its government, but I think that like the level of just sort of cartoon villain madness hadn't become the default setting in terms of their politics. That is absolutely a product of, you know, 54 years of occupation of the, you know, post the 1967 war. Don't get me wrong, like it wasn't great, but like there might have been some reticence in the sort of body politic in Israel to this sort of a thing, whereas let's just say that would not be the case nowadays.
Well, it's funny you mentioned, because like one of the events on this war that I think precipitated a lot of the like turn that Israeli occupation took were like a couple of war crimes that Israeli troops and Israeli border police did in the course of this. Because when they knew they were going to invade, they reinforced the Jordanian border, partly as a bluff and partly because they thought the Jordanians might like take the opportunity to try and invade Israel. And they just incidentally shot I think a few dozen Jordanian civilians with no warning. And this was like deemed to be wildly illegal. It went to court and everything. And it's, as far as I know, there's still the bulwark in Israeli law for what constitutes an illegal order. But everybody who went to jail for it was pardoned within a year, and the commander was fined 1 cent. So you kind of get the sense that this is like something that then goes on to like legitimize further things later. It's kind of a ratchet.
One thing that I think we can bear in mind, too, though, is that Israel did wind up taking over the Sinai in 1973, mm-hmm. Which now leads to the present day situation where it's sort of this internationally peacekeeping moderated zone. But yeah, there was some hesitation on Ben-Gurion's part in 1956. Mm. And obviously, like, it's weird because the dynamics in the situation were so different back then than they are now. This was still like a colonial operation. I think what made it interesting is the fact that, like, fundamentally, although Israel fought a war of independence or a sort of a guerrilla war of independence against the British in the late 1940s, like, there is obviously a huge amount of sort of political ties between the British and the Israeli state.
Oh, yeah, the IDF was based on like British lines because that's where a lot of its founders had been trained.
But fundamentally, this is, you know, a colonial war in which one of the ex-colonies is being asked to play the role of villain here so that the colonial powers can get what they want and can, for better, for lack of a better term, can remove a post-colonial leader who isn't towing the line.
Mm. Yeah. So basically, the Brits and the French come up with this thing they're calling Operation Musketeer, which is basically a two-day air campaign and then a sort of an air and seaborne assault to take the town of Port Said, which is right by the entrance of the canal.
Yes. And then they hand it to the weirdest guy in the British Army.
Stockwell.
Yes, this is General Sir Hugh Stockwell. And I have a long quote here from a French officer who served under him, which is to say that Stockwell was extremely excitable, gesticulating, keeping no part of him still, his hands, his feet, and even his head and shoulders perpetually moving. He starts off by sweeping objects off the table with his cane, or uses it to make golf strokes with the flower vases and ashtrays. These are the good moments. You will see him pass in an instant from the most cheerfully expressed optimism to a dejection that amounts to nervous depression. And
of course, I am the British general who is outwardly calm but prone to sudden and inexplicable fits of temper.
Yeah, he had eaten some very normal chocolate during the Second World War.
Yeah. There was a lot of competition for the British general, who is, of course, a little bit gay.
But so the planning of this is going back and forth because he vacillates and he goes back and forth. And he's never really told by Eden what the point of this is, whether it's to take the canal, overthrow Nasser, or both. And so the length of bombing and the areas to be bombed switch. They can't decide for months whether they're going to land at Port Said or Alexandria. And I feel like that's something you want to know when you're doing an amphibious operation, is where you're going.
Where you're going, yeah.
They don't figure this out for a long time.
Yeah, that does seem to... I mean, and this is one of the first areas where you get some sort of a Russian invasion of Ukraine vibes, which is just like a complete lack of clarity on what exactly they're supposed to be doing, which is kind of going to come up quite a lot over the course of this, because this isn't really a story of like kind of the British and French military fucking up so much as it's a story of like no one in politics really understanding what they're trying to achieve here.
Mm.
So this is then incorporated into like a bigger thing called Operation Revise, where phase one is getting air supremacy.
Operation final, this one, final, dot, yeah. Dot, dot.
That's right. Phase two is what they describe as Anglo-French Air Force is launching a 10-day aero-psychological campaign that would destroy the Egyptian economy. Yeah, we're going to destroy their vibes from the air.
Psychic warfare, yeah.
And then phase three is the air and seaborne landings to capture the canal zone. And so the British troops are looking pretty well trained. They're fine. Unfortunately, they have economic and technological limitations imposed by post-war austerity.
Yeah, this is the thing, right? Every sort of like British post-war conflict of the 50s is basically one of two things. We're either going to do the kind of small colonial police action where you can go in, do a bunch of war crimes out of the public eye, and then, you know, not worry about it too much. That's sort of like your Malaya, your Kenya, your Cyprus even. And the other is we're going to do like sort of large front warfare as part of like the UN, like in Korea. And so we're kind of only really good at these two things, and this one's kind of neither fish nor fowl.
Mm. Yeah, it's a curious one, isn't it? Because you get this kind of you get these two colonial powers who are going in, and they don't really know what exactly it is they're going for, and they're in this kind of weird period of sort of like semi demilitarization. Not as much in the French case. But the Brits are very much going with their traditional stance of the truest form of austerity where you even cut the cops and the army. meanwhile, the French are leaning heavily on their Régiment de Parachutistes Coloniaux, which I presume is sort of similar to the Foreign Legion.
Sort of. I think this is more like your kind of dead-eyed, well, similar kind of dead-eyed psychopaths to the Foreign Legion. But I think it's like you're recruiting from like white Frenchmen from the colonies, and you're also kind of like, so it's that kind of like pied noir kind of like
the same kind of mentality as the regiment that was planning on doing a parachute operation on Paris to overthrow de Gaulle.
Yeah, exactly. The OAS came from this sort of background. Also, fun thing, these guys are Vietnam veterans before that was cool. And the tactics that they used in Vietnam, not good, not great. And so they have this sort of like, let's say, war crimes intensive aspect, where they just,
ooh, yeah,
they just,
we'll get into this.
Okay. I don't mean to spoil.
I just want to throw in a really funny story really fast. One of my best friends from the army, from college and from the army, is a Green Beret now. And when we were in college, he told me the story that he watched the movie We Were Soldiers with his parents. And when he was in high school, he was what he would describe as a turbo nerd. He played the trumpet and marching band and stuff like that. Now he's a Green Beret. That's not a particularly uncommon life progression to go from, you know, from this day forward, I'll never be nerdy again. And then you just go like super hardcore into special forces. But he was watching with his mom. And in the opening scene of We Were Soldiers, there's like French army patrol in Vietnam in the 1950s. And it's just like hot and gross. And they're like walking through this like high grass, like elephant grass field. And this French guy just goes, putain de chaleur, putain de l'herbe, putain de pays. And then like, so they start hearing shots, and a guy fucking tries to play his military bugle. And my friend's mom was like, look, there's a bugler. And then, as if to excite him, because he plays the trumpet, then the bugler gets shot in the neck and dies. And she was just like staring at it aghast. And he was,
shut up, that bugler. The real war crime is playing the bugle at the opposing side.
So that's what I think of when you talk about, I know there's much, much more to it, to include building your impregnable base inside the bowl of a huge valley that then gets owned from all sides, from the mountains at Dien Bien Phu.
Yeah, our artillery will never receive counter-battery fire. 3 days later, you are shooting yourself with your own revolver out of shame. Mm.
But the thing is, when the bugler getting shot in the grass field is what I think of whenever you talk about, yeah, Vietnam veterans before it was cool, the guys who were French colonial war in Vietnam veterans. So those guys, I imagine being involved. I'm sure they were awesome and not at all terrible.
It's been a little bit overstated since, but there were some guys who, let's say, came from a Germanic background who suddenly came to enlist in the French Foreign Legion in 1945 or 6. They're all Swiss. Basically, they said they're all Swiss.
That's strange how this happens.
Yeah, and then they went to Vietnam, went to Dien Bien Phu, and got owned again. So, just two time elves. Yeah.
My Lithuanian friend was telling me that there was quite a thing in like Lithuania in the 80s and early 90s of people who were just trying to get out of Lithuania would go and enlist in the French Foreign Legion, and in true Eastern European style would quite often just not tell anyone they were doing this. So it was like not uncommon for some family just to be like, oh yeah, our son just disappeared and no one knows where he is. And then 10 years later, he just shows up jacked.
That the French Foreign Legion still exists at all is just incredible. Like, it's so weird a concept.
Yeah. Well, now they have that rule where it's like, you have to tell us if you're on the run for a crime. You can't just...
takes all the fun out of it.
Well, one thing I think is very funny is that although the Rambo movies overhyped this, and I do not believe that there was a significant amount of direct support from the Soviet Union in terms of like military personnel, whereas in the Rambo movies, you get the impression that that the Soviet Union was like, they had like secret, you know, battalions of Soviet troops that were leading the North Vietnamese. In the time of Dien Bien Phu, that was the case, that there were Soviet advisors. So the possibility exists of a German war criminal, you know, ex-SS guy in the French Foreign Legion getting doubly owned, because not only does he lose the war, he gets held captive by the North Vietnamese and encounters his former Soviet foes from the battlefield. He's like, ah, fancy meeting you again.
Well, we can talk about sort of the ultimate war loser, a guy called Larry Turney, or Larry Thorne.
Oh, yeah, prefer, yeah.
Who was he was a Finn who fought the Soviets, lost, joined the Waffen-SS, fought the Soviets, lost, and then became American, joined the U.S. Special Forces, went to Vietnam, and got killed there. So he went 0-3 against communists.
I know we have to get back on topic, but I'll tell you one funny story. I knew a guy in the army. He was extremely bad at being in the military, but like, his dad was the most decorated Estonian-American military veteran. His dad was a guy named Yuri Tumepu, who had fled Estonia to get away from the Soviets, then enlisted in the U.S. military, fought in Korea as an enlisted soldier, then became an officer, and then fought in Vietnam. He had like the Distinguished Service Cross and I think 2 Silver Stars. He's now an Estonian politician. I don't know if he's a far-right politician, but I will say this much. I Googled his photo one time and I saw a photo of him giving a speech at an Estonian war veterans memorial, and let's just say the carving of the Estonian war veterans on the memorial, they were wearing familiar helmets.
Interesting.
And they were carrying familiar submachine guns. I will leave it at that.
Yeah. So as goes the actual war in Suez, they do the bombing and naval bombardments, and then they do these paratrooper landings to secure airfields, and then the Royal Marines essentially go in from the sea.
The aeropsychological thing does not work very well, not least because Eden is becoming absolutely deranged about this, as you kind of hinted at earlier. He is having these moments where he panics and panics and panics about Egyptian civilians, but also about like the possibility of killing Americans. They stop bombing a Cairo airport because they think the Americans might be evacuating their citizens from there.
So Eden is kind of in this like weird position of like, he's like doing a war, but at the same time doesn't really want to do any of the things that are involved in doing a war. And so he's kind of doing these like half measures to the enragement of one Winston Churchill, who from presumably like a pit of brandy and cigars somewhere in a stately home, said something to the effect of, "It's madness to go this far and no further." But yeah, so the actual war itself isn't like, we can get into some of the details, but it isn't like hugely an event. Like, it basically takes the Brits and the French about like a day and a half to capture the area they're trying to capture.
There's a few things that go on here. On the Israeli side, they begin the war by cutting all of the telegraph cables to the Sinai Peninsula by the expedient of flying P-51 Mustang fighters into the wires and using the propellers to cut them, which I think is insane.
You see, there is, and this is something that I think is going to come up later as well, because it's in my notes, is there are just certain aspects of Israel's conduct in this which are just such pure Israeli vibes.
Well, for
not
instance,
in the sense of being like particularly like devilish or anything, but just like in the sense of just strange things, just oddities that are just like, they just have like Israeli warfare written all over them.
Well, for instance, Unit 101, which is commanded by future Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, who just sort of like leads them into very highly defended Egyptian positions, just because that's sort of his style as a commander, is like aggression for the sake of aggression. And every other Israeli officer near him is like, you know, you don't have to attack the strong point. And he goes a bit sort of Luigi Cadorna here, and he's like, a 15th assault uphill against this this wire obstacle, which is just great, fantastic. This kind of came back to bite him a little bit politically in later life, when he got accused of being like a sort of a warmonger, and this was at a time when that was still like a harmful accusation in Israeli politics, that he was like too aggressive in the pursuit of these things.
So supposedly the Brits and the French managed this with 26 casualties, and there were about 1,000 Egyptian civilian casualties. However, this is where we get into some of the French conduct. During the fighting in the canal zone, the French paratroopers often practiced their no prisoners code and executed Egyptian prisoners of war. I've written normal.
Mm-hmm. Just yeah, totally normal. Meanwhile,
I like the idea of being like, it is just protocol. We do not take prisoners. You understand how it is, huh? I don't know. I would have to talk to my line manager.
The way that it's phrased is so like, it's in their culture, which is very strange. But that's what happens when you use colonial troops, as they do colonial violence. But also, like, the amphibious landings, they've settled on Port Said, which, as we've mentioned, is like small, medium-sized city. And the Egyptians sort of do some fairly competent urban warfare here. I mean, it's a city, it favors the defender, whatever, but like, and it's very uneven, but they do fall back in like pretty good order, and they like extract some casualties from this. The way that NASA uses this is to immediately have songs, postage stamps, and books commissioned calling it the new Stalingrad, in order to encourage the defenders. Vans with loudspeakers drive through the streets announcing that the Soviets have nuked Paris and London, and that World War III has started.
I just love the idea. I mean, I can't remember if it was Umm Kulthum who did these songs,
yes,
but I just imagine that's the equivalent. It's like the equivalent of the United Kingdom gets invaded, and so like on day two, there's a hit on BBC of Dua Lipa being like, "You're fucking getting owned." Like, it's just unbelievable.
By the Albanians,
shit.
So I'm in favor of it.
There are these weird moments where like five British officers get killed by one Egyptian guy who is just hiding in a cupboard with a submachine gun, who just like jumps out like surprise. They
our one vulnerability: wardrobes.
It's so fucking weird. Also, one of the defenders of Port Said is a young Palestinian fighter by the name of Yasser Arafat. And when the fighting breaks out, his platoon of Palestinians, all but three of them desert outright. And then, because their job is to destroy useful infrastructure, Yasser and his two friends blow up an ammunition dump on the wrong side of the city that the British never come near. And that's their entire war.
It's actually just to destroy some of their own supplies. Great work. Yeah, so NASA's doctrine during this is that he declares it to be a people's war, and he not only arms a bunch of civilians, but also gets all of the army to dress in civilian clothes, reasoning that this is going to create an issue for the British, who are going to not want to kill civilians. And he presumes for the French, although I'm beginning to get the vibe from the French parachute regiment that this wasn't really an issue.
No, the French are like fully dripping blood at this point. They're thriving. But Eden is kind of very much like the aero-psychological warfare has been turned around on him. And now he's having a little psychological moment of his own, because he kind of tries to micromanage this a little bit. It also doesn't help that Hugh Stockwell is also insane. And so you just have this like force pushing downwards from Whitehall that's just like, well, do this. No, do this. Do this. Do this. Do this. And it just kind of like really kind of throws the Marines for a loop a little bit. They still do well, but it's...
Yeah.
I don't know, this surreal atmosphere that kind of prevails.
Yeah, there's a weird like push-pull thing going on. Meanwhile, speaking of the Royal Marines, British commanders of Number 45 Commando assaulted by helicopter, meeting stiff resistance with shore batteries striking several helicopters, while friendly fire from British carrier-borne aircraft also mistakenly hit 45 Commando and HQ. One Marine was killed and 15 wounded when a carrier-based Wyvern mistakenly fired into a concentration of Marines. This being a classic one of, like, the Brits being more of a danger to themselves than the enemy actually is. But this is the best bit. The helicopter-borne assault of 45 Commando was the first time helicopters were used by UK forces. Lieutenant Colonel N.H. Taylor, who was leading 45 Commando, was landed by mistake in a stadium still under Egyptian control, resulting in a very hasty retreat. I say.
Just in time to, like, throw out the first pitch and then leave.
That's a funny uniform you chaps have on. What are you from, the Fusiliers?
He's like sort of like boosting them about the creases in their uniform, but he gets like three troops in before he realizes they're Egyptians.
Yeah, to be fair, the kind of absolute sicko you have to be a fucking Marines colonel is just like very, like, I can imagine him just kind of accidentally putting himself in charge of the Egyptian forces because he's yelling at them all so much that they're just like, okay.
Well, bear in mind that this whole thing started in part because NASA had orchestrated the dismissal of the British head of the Arab Legion, a guy called General Sir John Glubb, but who was...
name alert.
Yeah, exactly.
Who had kind of gone native a little bit and who was known to his subordinates as Glubb Pasha.
This always seems to happen. There always seems to be a British guy who really, really just gets in character. Like, yeah. Like, you say what you will about Americans, but when you read a story about a guy who's like, oh yeah, a British guy who basically faked being Afghan so he could go on Hajj, like, that makes sense. It's a British guy. Like, yeah. You know, some guy from the 19th century who just, you know, basically decided he was going to go native and he was going to, like, learn every language and just, you know, live out the lifestyle of the subject of the empire. Like, that is a thing. Like, there's a switch you can flip in a British guy's brain and he'll just do that.
Yeah, same with, like, British Indian Army officers too. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, a lot of British top brass from back in the day have this very kind of, like, Tobias Fünke energy, where they're constantly getting in the zone for a role.
Incidentally, so, I'm learning just now from checking his biography to make sure that I got his name right, that Glubb's father was called Major General Sir Frederick Manley Glubb.
Incredible.
That's such a good name.
No relation of Manly Power, another British commander.
Yes, Admiral Sir Manly Power. Just a lot of guys going around.
America's Manly Power is Boily Power.
I should also point out that the Americans during this whole process have been very much alive to what's going on, thanks to John Foster Dulles's weird brother, Alan, who's director of the CIA, and who sent a guy early on to meet NASA under the pretext of assassinating him. This guy was called Miles Copeland Jr. He was a CIA officer.
No, that's Stuart Copeland's dad.
Yes.
That's the fucking, the drummer from the Police.
Yes, the drummer from the Police's dad was a CIA officer who was sent to Egypt, and the idea was that he was supposed to assassinate NASA, report back that it was impossible so the British wouldn't try. And so he goes to Egypt. The first thing he does is he finds NASA, introduces himself, and is like, yeah, I'm supposed to assassinate you or pretend to. And the two have this very long, surreal conversation about how they would contrive his assassination. He suggests, like, poisoning his tea, and NASA's like, well, I'd notice. And if I didn't notice, my guy over here would notice. And so he comes back with,
tea guy.
Yeah. What if I, like, you know, got another guy to bring in a poison cup of tea, and NASA's like, well, that would only poison the guy who taste tested my tea. So it's like just so fucking weird. But so NASA has like a line, a back channel to the Americans through this, and the Americans are, shall we say, not best pleased at how this is all going.
The Marines, the Paras, the Royal Tank Regiment, and the French Paras are embroiled in this kind of painstaking effort to clear Port Said of snipers, which goes on more or less until the UN basically orders a ceasefire. And in the midst of all of this, the Egyptians, despite being kind of like roundly trounced militarily, have done the most Joker mode thing, which is sinking every ship currently in the Suez Canal, causing it to be completely blocked and useless.
Incidentally, you mentioned cupboards being the natural enemy of the Englishman. They managed to kidnap a British army officer and accidentally suffocate him to death by leaving him in a cupboard. So really just six officers die to cupboards in the course of this operation.
Like the belligerents listed on the Egyptian side are also cupboards. Yeah. I mean, look, if you put a British army officer in a darkened cupboard, the likelihood of him suffering some kind of a asphyxie wank accident is high.
But how does he get this orange in there?
Yeah, that is very true. He had to use a date, you know, sometimes needs must. Yeah, and so essentially, towards the end of this, the UN Security Council has kind of worked out that the Brits, the French, and the Israelis are working together. The magician act of you and I have never met before, is that correct? Not really cutting any ice. And the US and the Soviet Union are, in a weird turn of events, united in condemning this.
Yeah, the Soviets threatened to nuke London and Paris, Khrushchev does, and he's convinced for the rest of his life that this has worked and this is the thing that has deterred neocolonialism. Like, this is genuinely like a sort of approximate cause of the Cuban Missile Crisis, is he thinks, well, okay, brinksmanship works and we should do more of it. And incidentally, at the time that he has these letters sent, the Soviet nuclear arsenal amounts to 4 IRBMs in a swamp. I'm not sure why they included the detail that they were positioned in a swamp, but that makes it that much funnier to me. This was a total bluff.
Excellent. Well, I mean, setting the stage for kind of a very Russian way of doing things in time to come is just pretend that your capability is much greater than it is. I mean, and also in incredibly Russian style, the USSR is on the one hand being like, this is very naughty, doing all of this, sending troops into somewhere just because you don't agree with them, and is simultaneously invading Hungary. Like, literally, during the same week. It's like, and this is part of the reason why the Americans are so pissed off about it, is because they're trying to gin up this big, like, anti-communist revulsion against the Soviet invasion of Hungary. Meanwhile, the Europeans are busy wanking themselves into a frenzy in Egypt.
Should also talk about the sort of domestic response to the war within Britain, which is very strange, right? Because, like, When the war started, there was this kind of feeling of, why did you wait 3 months and then do nothing? Like, it took a lot of people by surprise. And what's curious is that on the left, a lot of socialists found that the sort of, like, proletarian aspect of the movement was foursquare behind the war the second it started. Just, I guess, out of, like, muscle memory, least from the Second World War, that, like, once it was on, a bit like the Falklands, I suppose. Once it was on, you were either like with us or you were against us. And if you were against us, then you wanted to see our boys get locked in cupboards and killed.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, I would say that's the same. Opposition to the war in Iraq was not as big in America as it was in Europe and elsewhere in the world. But there was an anti-war movement, and I think once the war actually broke out, that exact same thing happened. Once the U.S.
same
invaded,
with the, like, hard hat riots that, like, Nixon sort of orchestrated.
Yeah. Once it actually was on, yeah. I mean, like, anybody who spoke out against the war was effectively blacklisted and treated like a traitor. Like, it genuinely, that switch flipping did happen. And so I guess I'm not surprised, even though this is, like, such naked, obvious colonial aggression.
It was absolutely, like, despised by the sort of, like, middle classes, I suppose you would say, and, like, the intellectuals. And I found, incidentally, a sort of 1950s Brendan O'Neill. A.N. Wilson, who wrote, although the bulk of the press, the Labour Party, and that equally influential left-leaning party, the London Dinner Party, were all against Swedes, together with the rent-a-mob of poets, dons, clergy, and ankle-socked female graduates who deplored British action, they did not necessarily constitute the majority of unexpressed public opinion. A majority that may be as high as 1,984%.
A number that may, in fact, number 28 years from now.
And, like, the Eden Ministry very nearly just, like, took over the BBC over this. Because it was like, sort of this very repressive instinct that existed, but also Britain was like halfway to a dictatorship still back then. And so the fact that you would have the BBC saying, oh, well, maybe this isn't such a like a good idea, absolutely inexcusable. And I think we came this close to like the nominal editorial independence of the BBC just being totally obliterated and it just being like state news.
You would have gotten the 1956 version of Laura Koonsberg in a North Korean uniform pointing a gun in your face on TV.
Yeah, exactly.
Lord Koonsberg is here to tell us about the South African government and why it's very good. So, the reaction to it in Britain is weird. And I think a lot of people have hypothesized that it's essentially, as you were saying, Alice, because they didn't do it soon enough. Mm. They didn't really get involved on the kind of initial hype about NASA and so on. Meanwhile, Britain and France on the UN Security Council are using their veto to block resolutions against them, which is like, remind you of anything.
Yeah, playing the hits. Absolutely.
Yeah. Classic stuff. Just like, no, you can't. Try it. No. Ah, see, it's almost as though this system is poorly designed. And also, as this is going on, the British currency is collapsing and Britain is in need of an IMF loan. Meanwhile, Eisenhower is ordering his Secretary of the Treasury to sell the US government's sterling bond holdings, which would collapse the currency further. And the UK government was apparently at this point considering invading Kuwait and Qatar if oil sanctions were put in place by the US. And other favoured jokeified international relations player, Saudi Arabia, started an oil embargo against Britain and France. The US refused to fill the gap until Britain and France agreed to a rapid withdrawal, and other NATO members refused to sell oil they received from Arab nations to Britain or France.
It was that moment when we sort of stopped being an independent like superpower because Eisenhower was just able to turn the sort of the gas taps off.
Yeah, so Britain and France are essentially experiencing an intervention. They're getting some tough love from their friends.
I want to throw something out there that I think also is relevant here. I think it can't be overstated how much the American leaders of World War II fucking hated the British. Fucking hated the British. After putting up with Montgomery.
Yes, and putting Montgomery in charge of everything really did not pay off for us down the line.
And it's like if there was anyone who would have come out of that war fucking hating the British military, it's Dwight Eisenhower. Like, because he had to deal with them and their bullshit for so many things. I mean, he was the supreme Allied commander in Europe. Like, he absolutely had to fucking put up with it and deal with just all of the foibles of the...
Prefer to do it my way, kind of thing. I'm not sure why I voice Vernon Montgomery as Roger Moore, but...
the birthday boy, Vernon Montgomery.
I'm just a little birthday general.
I just love a little bit of Alamein on my birthday.
To wear two badges on my beret because I'm a little birthday boy.
Do you have any idea how many times I've been shot? I could have gone mad from the lead poisoning alone.
And like, of course you had Americans like this, like Mark Clark and stuff, but nowhere
Mark Clark
powerful.
Is a hell of a name.
Mark Clark was a weird fucking guy.
Yeah, he was, yeah.
But yeah, but nowhere near as sort of all powerful as Montgomery. And like, even like Slim and Wavell, like, but all of those guys were also kind of like incredibly annoying to work with. I would say, and there's the main thing.
Yeah, so essentially this forces the Brits to pull out, which then also forces the French to pull out.
Did you catch the bit about the precise like timing of the ceasefire? This is one of my favorite parts. At the time when the British forces in the canal zone are told to cease fire, they're just stuck in open desert opposite like entrenched Egyptian positions with nothing nearby to defend themselves with. And so what they end up having to do is to like fudge the numbers a little bit and pretend their radio isn't working for 15 minutes so that they can advance far enough to entrench somewhere.
That's incredible.
The unluckiest Egyptian forces in the entire theater.
Yeah, you think you're saved by the bell, but instead they're just like, no, what time is it? None of us have watches suddenly.
Oh, I didn't hear that bell. Terribly sorry.
Couldn't hear it from inside this cupboard.
This is where things get a little bit fascinating. A British dispatch, at which point the captain, with a complete disregard for his own safety, threw himself into the cupboard. So the UN sends in a peacekeeping force in and around the canal and the Sinai made up of Danish and Colombian soldiers, a deeply cursed cultural exchange.
Yeah, we accidentally invent the modern concept of peacekeeping. And one other weird thing is we get a new Canadian flag out of it.
Because
part of the next wave of peacekeepers were Canadians, and the Canadian flag at this point was
red flag with the British, the Union Jack, and three maple leaves.
Yeah, and the Egyptians objected to being peace kept by troops with the British flag on their sleeves, so they that prompted the adoption of the maple leaf flag that we know and love.
Yeah, and so this is where we get into my favorite. I mean, the Israelis, for all of the fact that we haven't covered them as much in this episode because it is Britannology, actually did far more fighting than the British or the French did, because they're in fact engaged in a kind of like land-based tank war against the Egyptians all over the Sinai.
With Shermans even. Shermans against T-34s. It's like wild collection of equipment on both sides.
Oh, yeah, some relics have been brought out for this war. So the Israelis refused to host any UN force on Israeli-controlled territory and withdrew from the Sinai in March 1957. Before the withdrawal, the Israeli forces systematically destroyed infrastructure in the Sinai Peninsula, such as roads, railways, and telephone lines, and all houses in the villages of Abu Ghala and El Qasima. Before the railway was destroyed, Israeli troops confiscated Egyptian National Railways equipment, including six locomotives and a 30-ton breakdown crane for use by Israel Railways. Now, this is the most powerful Israeli military entry.
So we're taking your train on the way out?
Yeah, pulling up the railway track after them and loading it onto the back of the train as they drive out.
It's incredible. You're like waiting for your train in like Haifa and you're like, where did they get this from? And it's still got like a big Egyptian flag on the side.
Yeah, it's very funny to think of like the IDF in this particular war treating it like they're like playing The Witcher or something, and they're just like picking up everything they find and selling it to buy equipment.
See, I was thinking more that it's just like it was Israeli military katamari damashi. They're just rolling shit up bigger and bigger and bigger as they head west or eastwards.
And so then, rounding up, so the casualties, the British took 16 dead and 96 wounded. The French took 10 dead and 33 wounded. Israeli losses were 172 dead and 817 wounded. The number of Egyptians killed was never reliably established. Egyptian casualties to the Israeli invasion are estimated at 1,000 to 3,000 dead and 4,000 wounded, while losses to the Anglo-French operation were estimated at 650 dead and 900 wounded, with the 1,000 Egyptian civilians estimated to have been killed.
Big W for NASA. Who is like now convinced that he is going to be the savior of Pan-Arabism, and this sort of works out for him for a while. It prompts the French to want an independent nuclear deterrent, which they get. It also like in part prompts the creation of the OAS in North Africa, which leads to some deeply cursed times. And also probably precipitates the Cuban Missile Crisis. So fun times all round. Oh, also Eden is like forced to resign, sort of. First of all, he goes on holiday to Ian Fleming's house in Jamaica.
Awesome. Yes.
And then he starts getting sick. He starts getting like fevers, and he's forced out in a sort of palace coup. But there's this curious idea that it might have been quite a literal palace coup, because the theory is that his fevers and stuff, he wasn't actually that sick, but the medical advice was sort of tampered with. His doctor was leaned on to say, oh, if you keep working as prime minister, you are going to die in office. And it suggested that a certain shadowy royal family shaped influence happened to him, not least because Lord Mountbatten was very much against the war, but also because Eden wanted the royal family out of politics. He wanted a sort of like Scandinavian or Japanese style monarchy where they just had no like advice or consent powers whatsoever. And so I choose to believe that the queen herself personally arranged for his demise from politics.
Wouldn't it be really funny if he was actually getting poisoned by his doctor, and his doctor was Stuart Copeland? Or rather, Miles Copeland. It was Miles Copeland Jr.
Yeah, he got his son to do it.
He got his son to do it. The reason why his son is so good at drums is that he had to make a lot of noise to cover up for the manufacture of strychnine in his flat. I don't know, something like that. I do just find it very, very funny that the drummer for the Police's dad was basically a CIA guy notionally sent to assassinate Nasser.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It certainly takes a new meaning to that. Never ask the people in indie bands why their parents' names are blue on Wikipedia, which in Stuart Copeland's case is a very different vibe.
In 40 years' time, when we're all still doing this, the episode of Britannology that we do that involves Mitski's dad is going to be fucking great.
Wait, what is Mitski's dad?
Mitski's dad was in the State Department. I think he may have been a CIA. I don't know, but her mother's Japanese, her dad's American, and she was born in Japan, but her dad was in the State Department. It's very rare, like you said, indie musicians whose parents' names are blue on Wikipedia is one thing, but indie musicians whose parents' names are blue on Wikipedia who also lived in the Democratic Republic of Congo for some reason, very, very small list, and Mitski's on it. Good singer, though. I'm not going to lie.
Oh, great, yeah.
Anyway, I wanted to talk about this because I felt like it is such a turning point for Britain's influence in the world, and that prior to Suez, there was still this notion that Britain was one of like the big heavy hitters internationally, and Britain still maintains that notion, but it's not anymore. It's fundamentally not.
It's really strange how little a sort of psychic impact this made on British people, right? Like, it's sort of very, very easily forgotten. It's sort of like this ignominious sort of colonial incident that like is... A lot of people don't remember. It's not taught very much or very well. And so we didn't really learn from this. And I think that's why we're so weird about our own place in the world still. It's like we got about as owned as it's possible for a colonial power to get owned. And it just kind of like slid right off all of our brains.
But you could also make the argument that Britain then went on to get owned in Northern Ireland, fundamentally in the long term. And that didn't really, that certainly hasn't put a damper on it. And then also, I think the fact that Britain didn't get owned in Malaya, didn't get owned in Oman, and didn't get owned in the Falklands means that like there are positive examples that British sort of empire brain people can point to and say, see, we still matter. We still can project force however we want to. And I mean, I'm not saying what they did in Malaya was good. It was horrible. It was like the British winning colonial wars. There's this weird trick. It's called concentration camps.
We invented a doctrine of counterinsurgency based on do as many war crimes as possible, as hard as possible. And
where a lot of the
victory.
Troops we used were Rhodesian guys who are very normal.
Yeah, it was very funny to me because I was always told when I was a cadet, when I was a young officer, like, you need to read these books about Malaya insurgency or the Malaya emergency. There are all these things about, you know, how great Britain is at counterinsurgency, better than Americans. We can learn from them. And so finally, I did read it. And what I learned from reading about the Malaya emergency was their solution was, oh, yeah, the guerrillas are ethnic Chinese. Take all ethnic Chinese people out and put them in concentration camps.
Yeah. And then spend the next 70 years jerking yourself off about how good you are at counterinsurgency because you learned all of those lessons in Malaya and you learned all of those lessons in Northern Ireland. And so now we can just like have a 19-year-old walk around Lashkar Gah in a beret because that has a softer image to it and everything's going to be fine.
It's going to work just fine.
Normal country.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and that's basically why the... This is a bit like the Falklands in the sense that militarily the British and the French roll it up fairly easily, but is unlike the Falklands in the sense that there is like a huge amount of international and political opposition to what they're doing. And so like whereas the Falklands manages to be this kind of like sort of dudes rock enterprise where a bunch of like insane guys from the parachute regiment are allowed to just do what they want for a few weeks before everyone kind of dusting their hands off, job done. This one ends up in you have to stop firing in the middle of this advance that you're currently doing.
The thing is, if there is a Terry Peck in the Suez Crisis, he's almost certainly Egyptian and he's almost certainly the guy who just sprang out of a cupboard with a submachine gun.
Yeah, Terry Al Peck.
Well, there you have it. Alice, thank you so much for making time for this.
Oh,
this is a really fun episode.
Genuinely, I'm so pleased to come on and talk military history, especially.
I'm always blown away by your knowledge of military ephemera. I'm the one who should know stuff, and I don't know shit. I've read a couple of books, but you always have great anecdotes and details, so thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure.
Mm. Yeah, Alice is our military guy expert.
That's right. The guy finder general.
That's right, yeah. Well, if you're looking for types of army guy, look no further than Alice Caldwell Kelly.
But all I can say is, since this is a $10 episode this month, the second Britannology of the month, you are premium hogs, and we really greatly appreciate you. So thank you so much for being subscribers, and we will return with more Britannology next month.
Bye-bye.
Bye.